Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
We can.
So I know you're excited, but you got to do some work first. But this is not work. It's a lot of fun. It's going to be a fantastic segment, man. Today on Atlanta Business Radio, a little bit later in the program, we're going to get a chance to visit with the Vice President of Marketing Sciences with Marketing Workshop, Mr. Bud Sanders. And we're going to talk to the CEO, the Grand Poobah, with CrowdVested, Grady Thrasher. But first up on Atlanta Business Radio, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce the CEO of Blue Fletch. Please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Mr. Brett Cooper. Welcome to the show, man.
Excellent. Stone Lee, thank you guys very much for having me here this morning.
Sure. It's a pleasure. I think the question everybody wants to know is, where'd you get that name, Blue Fletch?
It's the fletching is the back part of the arrow. So it's not the 1970s Chevy Chase character, which is really
right.
Good.
So that's where I went immediately.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people go to. We actually made shirts at one point in time that had that.
To not be yeah. Chevy Chase. So it's the back of the arrow. So blue is, so you just match that up.
Yeah, if you look at arrow, you have different colors of the feathers, right. And randomly chose one. Blue seemed good. It's early in the alphabet. I mean, it's close enough, right?
So now how does that tie into what your service is?
Our main goal is to, we talked about it, the fletching is the part of the arrow that actually helps guide it straight. So mm-hmm. without the fletching, you have a big arrow that's wobbling through the air and does whatever it wants to do. We focus on mobile solutions for people. So, you know, as you go and try to build something in the mobile space, how do you like know what you're doing is the right thing? How do you focus it the right direction? And we're that guiding arrow or the back part of the arrow that comes in and helps people guide people the right direction. So
now, are your clients typically people who haven't played in the mobile space, or are they just want to get better in the mobile space?
It's a pretty big mix. I would say most of our clients are larger companies, a lot of larger enterprises. Atlanta's a great place for that. But we have what I call the 80-20 mix. So about 80% is larger companies that are looking for somebody to help come in, leverage newer technologies in the mobile mm-hmm. space. And the other 20% is a lot of cooler, smarter, smaller startups, not smarter. You guys are smart.
That would
too.
Be ridiculous.
Yeah, no. Startups, you know, go out and get funding, and they right. need somebody to help them build something very quickly and bring us in based on our expertise and the fact that we're good at doing it quickly. And are here in Atlanta, it's nice to have somebody close by to help you out.
Right. Now, are you finding that now for most businesses, it's very mobile-centric rather than it used to be website-centric, and then they kind of tack on mobile?
Yeah, well, I think if you go back to the people strategies in the 1990s, everybody would say, you know, we have a web strategy. We're coming out with an internet right. strategy. And now, if somebody says that, you might laugh at them. I think right. that in 10 years, mobile is going to be the same way, where it's just part of doing business.
Right.
So a lot of people are looking at it and focusing on it and saying, you know, that there's certain things people ask about, like, well, do I need a mobile app? Do I need X, Y, and Z? I think thinking about mobile as not a app or something that goes on the phone, think about it as, you know, people are connected to your business in your pocket at all times. How do I take advantage of that? And how do I, you know, build my technology to take advantage of those things?
But isn't having an app and then as opposed to having kind of a responsive web presence two different things?
It was in the past. I think the web technology is becoming now where it's very seamless. And you know, if you talk to, I think if you went to Mobility Live last year, that's a great speech by Matt Jones and Josh Farnan, I think, from Porsche. Matt Jones is from Home Depot. And they talked about, you know, they have their fantastic mobile apps they built for people to download, and then they ended up looking at their traffic, and it was still 90% of people coming through mobile web.
Right.
And so they looked at that and said, you know, people are still using this very heavily. Let's make sure that's a great experience for them, make sure we think about the right things. And the technology on the website has actually, you know, changed even in the last 24 months. So such a big difference that it's you know, it's smooth and seamless. And if you go back 2 years, like, web is kind of chunky and slow, and now it's fast and sexy.
But and having an app strategy would require the person to download the app and then click on the app in order to interact with the company, where a responsive website, you know, you can just go to your search and just search for it and it shows up the website, and then you're getting that mobile experience.
Yeah, which creates that volume. And,
right.
you know, it's the only times you really need a mobile app, I tell people, is if you start interacting with things on the device. So you can get from the web browsers, you can still get location. You can sometimes take advantage of the cameras. You know, if you want more detail out of the device itself, interacting at a low level, or want really high performance, like games and very visual interactions, that's where it starts to make sense to have a mobile app.
Right.
But you can get pretty far along with web technology these days.
But I wonder, is it coming or does it already exist to some degree? You take somebody like me and I decide, we're going to go to the Home Depot later this morning, honey, but let me get on the website first. But I grab my phone and I search or go to the website and it says, really? Wouldn't you rather do the app? Is there some kind of dealio like that?
A lot of sites do that. And
they do?
My general experience is I'm kind of annoyed by that.
Oh, okay.
You know, I'm like looking up a product and I go search the product and pulls the website and it's like, hey, would you like to install the app too? I'm like, no, I'd like you to tell me about the product.
Just tell me how much it costs.
Yeah.
So I know if I should go here or Target.
Yeah, just tell me the price. And I think that, thinking about, are you annoying the customer is a good question to be asked.
That's a good idea.
Is that part of your whiteboard when you're working with a new client?
Yeah, I don't actually have it on the list, but it's probably, I might stick it in there with that little Socratic questioning.
I think that was probably his marketing guy's contribution. I think that's a smart thing. So were you surprised at all? Did you anticipate the explosive growth this quickly to all this mobile activity? Did you anticipate it happening that fast 3, 4, 5 years ago?
So we started the company in 2008. So myself and my business partners actually came from Anderson Consulting, or changed his name to Accenture, and worked in their mobility group, which back in the old days was a big box that you connect and sync its data through a cable. So it's much different than what the kids have these days. So we started the company about a year after the iPhone came out, and you were focused on enterprise mobility, and it wasn't, it was 2008 and 2009 weren't that good of a time in the economy, but after a couple of years, people started looking at mobile seriously and saying, this is something that's going to make sense and help us with our business and help our customers interact with us. So it's definitely, we saw a lot of those pieces coming, but we thought they would happen faster than they have.
And oh, really?
It took a couple of years, and the economy being bad didn't really help with that, I think, for the 2 year stint there.
And now the smartphone seems so much more evolved than when you look back to the early smartphone.
Yeah, and people forget about how different it was just 6 years ago. You didn't have an iPhone in your pocket, and the BlackBerry with the scroll wheel and black and white screen was what everybody had, and they thought that was the coolest thing ever. And now, if you can't get your streaming, FIFA World Cup in your pocket, you're upset about it.
You're like, what's going on? And on your Motorola Razr, it's hard to do,
Yeah.
So now, can you walk us through what it's like working with you? Like, so this enterprise has a pain. They're like, look, we think that we can be better in mobile. So they contact you. Is that usually what happens?
Reach out to us probably through just asking somebody else, who'd you guys use? And we'll get referred that way. And a lot of times we'll come in and do kind of three phases of projects. First phase is like POC. So somebody has, I have this small thing. I need it done really quick.
So it's a project. You're working on kind of like a beta project to kind of get a feel for it's a good working relationship.
Yeah, we want to build a new app and figure out it's going to work. Let's build the smallest piece possible and get it out quickly and test it with customers and our people first. So we'll do a lot of those POCs up front, and then that typically evolves in a relationship to having us help them with more strategy type projects and then larger business solutions.
So, is it the CMO that's contacting you, or is it like maybe a project manager and just working on something?
It would typically be people in the IT organization who have a need and typically won't have the resources or the experience on their team, and want somebody to help come in and augment their teams and bring with them the experience. And then, our big thing is we like to make sure that when we walk away, our clients have, not just the solution we build for them, but also the experience and know how to take it to the next step.
Because in the enterprise level, I would imagine there's a lot of security issues and a lot of, kind of less creative challenges in that regard, because you have to wade through all of their bureaucracy and their IT kind of security and all that.
Yeah, definitely. So I think a lot of the big things with the enterprise, one of the advantages we have is we're, we came from that consulting background. A lot of the people we hire are actually out of enterprise. We're not hiring, kids out of college who are, fantastic developers.
Cool app,
we're looking for people who know how to navigate that. Sometimes bureaucracy, I guess, is the right word for it, but knowing how to deal with that in addition to taking the newer technologies and apply it, on top of that bureaucracy and navigate around it.
Still have to add the element of creativity and user interface and all that.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people in a lot of big companies have really good ideas and struggle to have the technology or the acumen or even the right the big enough team to be able to take advantage of it. So we really come in and try to help out in that space and make those people successful. I think a lot of, being in a business for 5 years, you'll see things that you're like, if I only had the team or some money in our project to do this, and then we help fill that gap for a lot of folks.
So do you find yourself competing with offshore companies, and if so, are you having to compete on price at all, or are you taking a different path to distinguish yourself from those kinds of alternatives?
So for us, we're all of our team is here in Atlanta. So we have about 25 people here in town, and everybody I hire is senior level and above. So we don't necessarily compete with offshore. We can't compete on price; it's just something we can't do. But we find that a lot of times that we'll come in and a company will attempt something with an offshore team for like 10 months. And
so you like, you fix offshore work?
Is that sometimes, yeah. I think that it's,
we fix $300 nose jobs. Right, remember?
Right. Yeah. Mobile's especially hard. Mobile's especially hard to nail with offshore. And I think that, you know, having somebody that can come to your office, or you can go sit in their office that's 10 minutes away, is a very competitive advantage for us in that space. And we are a lot more expensive. But at the end of the day, like, our clients are looking to build something and get it out quickly. Time to market is very important, I think, now, especially in the mobility space.
So there's enough companies here in town that meet your profile that you can – what was that thing you say, acres of diamonds?
Acres of diamonds.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So Atlanta's a very good city, I think, for mobility in particular. And you look at the number of Fortune 500 companies in Atlanta versus, you know, any other city in the East Coast, and I think we're more consolidated than even like a New York or Chicago. And then the other thing, too, is the types of technologies, a lot of healthcare, a lot of finance, and those areas are moving towards the mobility space and trying to take advantage and figure out how to make that work. So it's a good ripe field of acres with diamonds, I guess.
Acres, what is it?
Acres of diamonds. There was a book written about
it. I think I'm mixing my metaphors there. But, we got it.
He's very Southern, so he throws these out periodically.
So I'm interested to learn more about how the sales and marketing piece works. Do you guys, in your arena, get together and show off your stuff, and big enterprise clients of the caliber that you need and want come and you show it off at trade shows and stuff, or are you out knocking on doors, or they're pretty much coming to you? How does the sales and marketing thing work?
We have done a terrible job at that for the first 6 years. So Steven Weber, who's actually here in the studio with us today, is we brought him in last year to help us out with this. And, you know, our first 6 years is all referrals. So do really good projects and then get referrals.
Well,
and
good
do
more work good is a good, good marketing sales strategy.
Yeah, that's a good strategy. And then, we sat down and said, we're a pretty big company. We should probably think more about how to tell the story of the good work we're doing outside of, just the people who know us. And for us, it's, we're definitely maturing and growing in that space and trying to do better and think about it, how to tell our message and our story.
So now Atlanta has been known as like a healthcare IT or fintech. You see us as a mobile hub as well?
So Atlanta is, there's a lot of mobility companies, and definitely right down the street from here, AirWatch was incredible, yes. Large mobile acquisition. Mm-hmm. And then the Chamber of Commerce, so we try to actively participate a lot with them. They're doing a lot around bringing mobile companies to Atlanta and focusing on mobile here. So, AT&T Mobility, AirWatch, at the top end. And then there's a lot of really small niche companies that are building at the Midtown Mile, where there's just tons and tons of mobile companies in those offices building cool technologies and doing really neat things. So there's even a conference here in town every year that the Chamber of Commerce puts on called Mobility Live, which is a great event for folks to go to, mm-hmm. if you want to learn about mobile, not just in Atlanta, but all over the world. Folks come from that.
Well, we've had Tino Mantello from TAG, and he talks a lot about clusters and the importance of having some very large players involved and then building a cluster around those players. So I guess with AirWatch and AT&T Mobility, that's kind of the driver. You're getting a lot of people that are either selling stuff to them or working with them. So that's creating this hub.
Definitely. And you also get that great education system here in Atlanta. So you get Kennesaw State, SPSU, Georgia Tech, Georgia State, Emory, and UGA is really close by, with a lot of really good students, mm-hmm. who are interested in computer science. For the young kids, they grew up with mobile devices,
right.
in their pockets, and
exactly.
it's second nature to them. So having a lot of good young talent, I think, really helps a lot of these companies.
Now, are you seeing an increase in women involved in the technology?
It's hard. I think that in general, women in technology has been, that there's that 15-18% cap that's just been consistent. My wife and I talk a lot about this and that problem, and she's actually working on doing a charter school with somebody here in town focused on technology. And one of the things they talk about a lot is, getting women engaged earlier.
Right.
So in middle school, getting them engaged, because by the time they get to high school and college, if they're not, thinking about engineering and in the STEM track, they're probably not going to focus on it in college. So,
your wife's a technologist?
She's working on a charter school. So her and one of my old CEO I used to work with are focused on, they're building the Southern STEM charter school.
So, we'd love to. Do you mind connecting us?
I'd like to get them in the studio.
We work with Women in Technology, the WIT group. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Yeah.
But they... that's a big, important issue to try to raise that number of girls and women involved in technology.
Yeah, so I think their thing is, thinking about the talent pool of, there's a lot of people in that, their example is, you graduate from high school and you can make $11 working at Kroger or you can drop out of high school and make $11 working at Kroger. How do you take that, you know, the kids in school and get them to think about technology in a different way?
Right.
You know, give them even some basic trades and skills that'll help them earn a living wage. And I think in Atlanta, you know, women are great spots in a lot of like lower income areas. They're the breadwinners in the family. So
right, which to me it's strange when we have these shows where we talk to the WIT folks. It's the girls love technology. It's not like they're not using technology. It's just to get them to think about creating the technology, you know, to change the mindset from being a user to a creator.
And exposing them to early enough, seeing that there is that opportunity to go right. and do it, which is, you know, if you get that early exposure and you see this is, you know, this will work for me, I can do this.
Right, it's doable, it's possible. Yeah,
so creating that possibility is very, very, that's, you know, do it early and then, you know, you'll take a couple of years, but you eventually get there.
I just got a text. We lost the Kroger sponsorship.
Yeah, thanks.
I meant 1170. Sorry.
So I got to ask before we wrap, your backstory, man. How did you get involved in all this?
So I was been in Atlanta for about 25 years. Came here, went to high school over in the Clarkston area, and then went to Georgia Tech.
So that was a big technology hub there.
It was
Clarkston, right?
Not quite so much. It's got the prison. It's got Memorial Drive. It probably used a little upgrading.
Right.
But you know, went to Georgia Tech and went into computer engineering and did computer security coming out of college for Anderson Consulting, and that took me into the mobility group when they started doing that in the early 2000s.
So you saw the beginnings of AirWatch. Were you aware of that?
I was at one of their pre-competitors. There's a company called Afaria. It's called Afaria now. It was called ExcelNet, and I worked for them. It's actually a couple blocks from here in 1996 through like 99.
So it could have been you in AirWatch, huh?
It could have been me. Yeah. I think no. Those guys are pretty impressive.
Right.
Maybe one day I'll be like Alan and them, but. But you definitely, you know, did that route for a couple of years. Did a lot of consulting. You know, worked at Coca-Cola for a while, doing some auditing and security for them. And then around 2008, decided I wanted to step out on my own. So called a couple of the guys I worked with, and the four of us started the company together. And at the same time, I was going to Emory, getting my MBA through their executive program down there, which is you know, a great opportunity here in town. Like a lot of good educational systems here in town. So I really enjoyed that. And then just grew the company over the last few years, and it's been a great trip for me.
Well, it's been a fantastic conversation for us. Well, the conversation's been adequate, but we got to lead to a really great interview with the wife.
Right? Yeah,
excellent.
That's a win.
This is normal for me, though. Right.
You're used to it. Where can our listeners go to learn more?
If you want to find out more about us, our website is www.bluefletch.com. I don't know if you need the www, but it helps to put that in there.
That's right.
It might kick it off. Or if you want to email us at info@bluefletch.com, BLUEFLETCH. There's an L in there. Kind of like the Chevy Chase. Think about it. It's got the... It's a good movie, but thank you guys very much for having me on today.
Oh, well, you're more than welcome. In all kidding aside, it really has been an absolute pleasure visiting with you guys. Keep up the good work, and come back and visit with us again sometime, man. Keep us posted.
Excellent. Thanks, Don. Thanks, Lee.
You going to hang out with us while we visit with our next guest?
Definitely. I'm excited about hearing these guys.
All right. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio this morning, we have with us the gentleman from Marketing Workshop, Vice President of Marketing Sciences. Please join me in welcoming Bud Sanders. Hey, man, did you learn anything in that last segment?
I did. There's some good stuff. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
So let's talk about what you're up to. What's happening over at Marketing Sciences?
Marketing Sciences, well, we're a division or a department in Marketing Workshop. Marketing Workshop's kind of a cool company. There's the old school market research company that, hey, I need to do a survey. And we'd go out and we'd get paper and pen, those things we used to use, and they'd go out and do the survey, and then they'd compile it by hand. And
do people still do that?
No. I take that back. They do. There's a place for that. Uh-huh. You can do some qualitative type work and in-store work, things like that. You can do that. But mostly now it's online. But the company's been around for 40 years, a little over 40 years. And about 3 years ago, they realized, you know what, let's move into the 21st century. Let's see what's going on. The industry is changing because there's so much do-it-yourself stuff out
there. So you guys
decided,
you know, this internet thing's probably not a fad.
Yeah, it's probably going to stick around for a while. Let's leverage this. Let's do something.
It's an opportunity. Research.
Yes.
And the internet.
Exactly. Saw this coming.
So in a business like yours, it strikes me as one of the things that can happen, and you've got to really get your arms around how to manage, is a client may really think they know what they want, and they think they know how you ought to go about capturing that data, and they're maybe more often than not quite right about either. And you have to manage those expectations and get them on the right track for their own sake, if not for the sake of the reputation and the quality and the caliber of work that you're putting out there in the market. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Exactly. And that happens a lot where the client will come and say, in fact, we were talking before the show about some situations that come up with, well, this is what I need to find out, and this is the answer I need. Like, well, okay.
So you don't really
this
need
is,
me.
This well, is a good place to start. But we just need data to confirm this. Like, well, what if the data doesn't confirm this?
Kind of well, thing. We're going to find a researcher that will confirm this.
Right. And so there's this challenge of, okay, do we ever want to do work with these people again? Or, you know, how's this going to work? And so there's a whole lot of education that goes on to try to explain, okay, well, what's the question? Don't worry about the answer yet. What's the question you've got? What are you struggling with? And that's what we're trying to do at the workshop is be more consultative than the typical market research company. I guess you can't see air quotes on radio.
But is that something that's hard to kind of manage the expectations of the client? It sounds like that's, you know, like you said, they want a certain outcome that fits into their paradigm. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, look, we're going to find out what is real.
And it is. It's managing those expectations. And if you get them to focus on the big picture, what is the problem you're having? Then we can go back and say, okay, well, that's a solution. May not be the best one, but let's find out. And when you get them to focus on the grander idea of what's going on, then they can see, oh, well, we could go in this direction or this direction or this direction. It isn't just this pigeonholed, we need to know that the answer is X before we can move forward.
Can you share like an actual, I mean, you don't have to mention the company's name, but what would be an actual thing you would research?
A lot of different areas. We'll do a lot of new product development. Where either in the food area, we do a lot of business in the food realm, either restaurants or CPG type areas.
And you're asking them if they would like bacon on their sandwich?
Right.
Or you're
the answer is yes.
How
you don't
many
need research for bacon.
Do we need two slices or do you need three slices? Well, there's several parts of it. There's the can we make our product better, thinking from a product standpoint. Can we make the product better? Can we sell more of the product? Mm-hmm. And kind of the more fun part of it in some ways is, who do we sell the product to? How do we better sell that product so we sell more of it? So are we going to the right people? Mm-hmm. So think about, am I selling it in the right part of town? Am I selling it in the right part of the country? That sort of thing. So it's there's a lot to that. How do we, once they come with the problem of, okay, we've got this product. It's a great product. We know it's a great product, but we don't know how to sell it. We don't know who's going to buy it.
Right.
Well, okay, maybe it's a great product. Let's work on that. So do maybe a segmentation study and find out what people really want in that area and come up with different target groups and say, okay, this group here, they're going to be all about it. This group, you probably don't need to waste your time over there.
So you've gone to some trouble to actually register a representation of something you call research-wise. Mm-hmm. It looks cool on paper, by the way, so it's got a good look to it. Mm-hmm. So the marketing guy, he's got to be happy with that, I'm sure. But tell us a little bit more about that. Does that represent specific disciplines, methodology, rigor, and discipline, or is it really just cool marketing?
Well, it's cool, first of all.
It is cool. It really looks good.
And you didn't see the whole owl metaphor that goes behind that. But that's.
I want to steal and do like radio-wise or business. Yeah, I don't know.
But it's just a catchphrase to kind of capture the philosophy we have about how we do research and how we're different.
Okay.
So the WISE stands for wisdom, imagination, science, and enlightenment.
He loves that.
I'm an acrostic junkie. Man, this is great. I love it.
So the wisdom speaks to our 40-year history. I mean, there's a lot of experience both in the company from its founders and then as the people have come in over the last few years. We try to get folks who either have client-side experience, so as we help our clients, myself included, being on the client side for a while, we know what's expected. Mm-hmm. So there's that wisdom piece. And the imagination is something that you don't necessarily get from a typical market research company where they'll say, all right, this is how we're going to do it. Here's your problem. This is how we solve it. We like to take that step back and say, all right, let's think creatively about this, which is tough because market research is typically a lot of left-brained analytic quant types. So to get creative, it's a special kind of person that needs to be able to work in that environment. So you take that step back and say, okay, well, how can we creatively solve this? We've got all these tools, but then how do we put them all together for a custom solution for this individual question that these folks have? Mm-hmm. And then the science is all the math and the stats and that sort of thing behind it. The cool part, being also a Georgia Tech grad, I'm glad to see that the jackets are well represented in this room today. We won't talk about the Emory thing, though. So the science is all that piece because it's all analytically sound. And one of my roles is everywhere I've been, and especially here, is the methodology police. You see something, you're like, you can't do that. What do you mean I can't do that? I just did. Yeah, but legally, all right, well, legally you could, but ethically, no. you just can't do that. And statistics have that bad rap of you can say anything you want to with them. So we got to rein that in and, like, okay, we can say this, we can't say that. Mm-hmm. And then the last piece, it all leads up to that enlightenment. Okay, now we've used all this wisdom, these creative solutions, and all the good science behind it. Now we've got this real great enlightened solution response, how you're going to go about your strategy, what you're going to do, how you're going to move forward. So it just ties in together our philosophy really well about how we look at an engagement with a client and what we've got behind it, kind of in the engine behind it to generate it.
So now what's the challenge from the marketing standpoint? Do most companies think they can just handle this internally, or they know what, like, they don't really need the research that they've kind of either have their gut feeling or they just see what other competitors are doing?
That's a good question. Larger companies typically know they need it and they don't want to have to deal with it. So they'll have an internal group that's responsible for fielding these things and hiring people like us to do it for them.
Right.
The smaller companies are a lot of the times where they think they know the answer, and
right.
so they don't, and they don't have the budget, realistically, right. especially in this environment. They don't have the budget to do it, so they'll just do it on their own.
So your clients are typically enterprise-level clients?
Typically. I mean, and there's some smaller. In fact, there's a kind of a research issue of my own of how...
Have you
how
done the research of what is the right size client?
The right size is a $3.2 billion company who closes their office on Friday.
Right.
So they're not expecting anything from us, essentially.
But do you have a sweet spot beyond size, like an industry cut? Like, do you do a lot of
Well, you mentioned
work?
food service.
Yeah, about right now, I think about 40% of our business comes from food in some way, shape, or form, either in the restaurant realm or
So a restaurant would hire
goods.
You, like, for mm-hmm. menu items or...
Menu items or menu mix or how to build their menu or what's the atmosphere in the restaurant.
Is so you must
good,
eat
bad,
well.
Different? Some folks on our staff do, yeah. There's
They have to go out.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff usually at lunchtime in the kitchen that shows up.
Right, so like, so a restaurant would hire you, like, can you walk through an engagement of restaurants, maybe a franchise? Mm-hmm. Are they a client typically?
Yeah, a lot of franchises.
Because they can't be wrong, right? You know, if you're a franchise, you want to get the right menu mix.
Right, and you don't have a lot of margin for error.
Right.
So typically with those clients, the engagement will go kind of soup to nuts, no pun intended, but... they'll start with, we've got some kind of idea of a product we want to throw out there.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do what we call a concept sort, and we'll just do an online survey where there's no food involved, just the description of it. And we'll do some fancy analytics behind there to say, okay, you threw out 12 ideas. These three are dogs. These three...
So what is like how do you execute an online survey?
We will... For those, we get their email addresses. Either we'll go to... a random that'll all be representative of their market. We'll screen to get the right.
Right. So they give you, like, this is the profile of our demographics that currently
mm-hmm.
eat here.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's who their current customers are. Sometimes it's, well, we want to expand.
Who we want, yeah.
Right.
So we want to get out and, you know, who are we not reaching that we want to reach? And a lot of times you'll find out, particularly in the restaurant world, that some of the products will be very attractive to people who aren't going there. And they're very different from what they're currently doing. So there's that tension of, well, how badly do we want to go after the new
right.
the new dollar with
or
this?
Is
this
going to turn somebody off? Or do we add an incremental dollar to our existing client
base? Exactly. And that's a big question of mm-hmm. how to do that. So we'll do those concept sorts, and then we'll narrow it down. And then we actually have a facility as part of our organization that with a commercial-sized kitchen where we can bring their chefs in, and they'll make this stuff. And we'll bring folks in for kind of a glorified focus group for a taste test. And then they'll go through that.
I'm just thinking, enterprise-level clients and relatively established, mature industries, maybe some new ones as well, it seems like this would be the kind of thing where you have to go in and almost unseat somebody else. Somebody else is already in there doing marketing research, aren't they? That's got to be a tough sale.
Sometimes it is, and that's why the relationship is so important. I mean,
yeah.
we talk in business so much about, oh, it's all about the relationship, but in research especially, it really is. Because there are some folks out there, and I say this because I've worked for some, who they have a very cookie-cutter approach.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll come and say, okay, well, this is what you're going to get. And they have a name for it, and they have a whole...
And that includes these amount of focus groups and two of these online things and six of them.
Exactly. And the chart you're going to get at the end is going to look like this. And,
right.
and that's fine. But there's no...
Customizing it to the exact. It's more consultative that you're trying to hear exactly what they're trying to accomplish, and you have lots of tools that might benefit them.
Right, and they feel better because we all feel better when we feel like we're being heard. Right.
You know,
and they feel like, okay, you really did listen to me. We had an engagement the other day with a prospective client, and in this particular realm, it's stretching us a little bit, but we're really competing against more of the Accentures and the McKinseys and the BCGs of the world, and which is way outside of our typical sweet spot.
Right.
But we just realized during the conversation, okay, this is who we're competing against. But where we were the preferred, at least at this point, and we'll see how this plays out, to be continued, what they were really interested in was because with a typical BCG type situation, they'll bring in the partner for that initial meeting,
right?
And hear all these great things, and then they'll never be seen again.
Exactly.
Right, he's gone.
And then they've got the first year MBA who's out there just churning all the work out,
right?
And then maybe they'll come back, maybe at the end for the presentation,
right?
And so when they said, "Wait, we're going to see all these senior people through this whole process," I'm like, "Oh, well, that's different."
And then imagine if you were able to go, and you should see this mobile app that we're going to throw in.
That's right.
That's right.
Take that to another level.
That's right. And then when they see that the price tag is not necessarily seven figures just to have that conversation, then it makes a big difference too.
Well, I'm thinking they ought to put us in the front end of the engagement and let us interview the prospective client. We'll put them through the ringer, right?
Bring them in here. You sit over there.
You tell us what you want to know.
Thumbs up, thumbs down.
Right. That could be fun.
That's enough of them.
This must be incredibly rewarding work because you must learn a ton almost daily in this kind of work.
You do. It's not boring. In fact, when I decided, well, I'll go off on the client side for a little while and see what that's like, and after a year of that, it was boring. Because it was the same product,
right?
The same thing. And it was, it was cool to be part of a brand team and all this. But after a while, you just realized, okay, there's more than this. I remember the way it used to be. So coming back to this side, you could have half a dozen completely different products, types of companies that you're working with before lunch.
Wow.
And in some ways, it's almost, you become Sybil. You know, your head is just going all over the place. You're like, you hear those voices.
Well, because you have to be in the moment for each one of them.
Right. Because
and
they don't
can
care.
Be completely opposite.
Yep. And if that phone rings and it's one of them, they don't care about the other five. They just care about them.
Right. Yeah, so that's the marketing workshop strategy, right? Where can you share that exactly how that works? How is that different than the company as a whole?
Well, that is marketing workshop is the
is
company.
This? Okay.
So, yeah. Marketing sciences is our division within marketing workshop. So I head up more the analytic group.
Okay, so that's the science part.
Mm-hmm, that's the science part.
That's the S.
That's the S. Yes.
You're remarkably articulate and fun for a math guy, I gotta say.
I get that a lot, actually. So I don't know whether I fake one of them really well. I'm not sure which. I'm not going to say which.
All right, so let's make sure that we leave our listeners with some coordinates so they know who and how to get in touch with and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. www.mwshop.com. And again, I don't think the www is necessary. And then I believe it is info@mwshop.com. Or just go to the website, and there's plenty of links there.
Now, what's the pain that a listener would be having that they're like, we got to call these guys? What's a typical point of entry for you?
A couple. If they're doing research and they're really not happy with what they're getting, and they're either struggling with the people they're dealing with, or we didn't get a chance to get into all this. But if they're finding they've done all this research and it's not leading to anything. So one of the things.
So nothing actionable. One way or another.
Or it's actionable, but they take the actions and it either fails or just nothing comes of it. So one of the initiatives we have that we're trying to spearhead now is, and it's the holy grail of market research, is what's the ROI. What return am I getting on that marketing research dollar that I'm spending?
Mm-hmm.
So we're putting a lot of thought behind that of how do you do that? Because when you can show that, then our job's easy. Then I wouldn't need you guys to come in and have them come in here and have you guys screen them. You just
right.
say, oh, wait, we know how much we're going to get out of it? And that's the holy grail.
Well, isn't that tricky, though? Because sometimes you might get out of it of the research might say, you shouldn't do that.
Right.
Which is
good information because you think about
it. There's no money to be made when they're not doing it.
But
it's just saving
money.
It's saving
it. It could be huge.
And if the alternative we were all set to go down this path, and now that we're not going to, we just saved $2.5 million.
Mm-hmm.
So that $250,000 we spent on the research came back tenfold.
Right.
So even if you don't do something, you can determine what it is, what that
payback is. So you can make an ROI for that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Website one more time.
www.mwshop.com.
All right. Well, one more thing. Do you have some local clients?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I think it'd be neat if you're up for this, Lee, at some point, maybe bring a delighted client in the studio if they're willing to talk about it and kind of get it from their perspective and maybe walk through.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be cool. Yeah.
Don't you think that'd make for a good segment?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Kind of get their take on it?
That'd be fun.
All right. So we ought to explore doing that.
Okay.
All right. You going to hang with us? We got one more guest we're going to visit with. We got to get him up from his nap, but then.
Absolutely. We'll shake him a little bit over here. Absolutely. No, thank you guys. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. It's the moment we've all been waiting for. Lee, the headliner. This is the guy. He is with CrowdVested. He's the CEO. Please welcome.
He has the best name.
He does. He does have the best name. Please welcome Grady Thrasher. How you doing, Grady?
I'm doing great, Stone. Thank you, Lee, for having me on today.
So what all are you vested in professionally, personally, financially?
I thought he was a wrestler. Oh. It was a great wrestling name.
Yeah, that's an old Atlanta name, I tell you. It's, I'm actually the fourth. I've been around. Henry Grady, so that's two old Atlanta names there. But CrowdVested is what we're doing, and CrowdVested is a way to invest in real estate, and it's a way for individuals who don't have access to commercial and residential real estate investment opportunities to get in for a real low threshold, as low as $500 for an investment.
Oh, wow.
But you're utilizing the crowdfunding platform?
That's exactly right. It's a form of crowdfunding, and you know, for those out there who don't know, I think everyone knows what crowdfunding is now, but it's up till now, crowdfunding has been basically Kickstarter.
Right.
And Indiegogo and sites like that where you can go and buy a product or donate to a dance troupe or something fun. But what you got back was either that product or just a good feeling. You know?
And a T-shirt.
Right. This is a new way to do crowdfunding, and it's investment crowdfunding. It allows you to get back an actual investment return as opposed to a T-shirt.
Now, is this because of the law in Georgia that allows them – to be one, I guess they're one of the first states to allow companies to invest in other companies in this manner?
That's exactly right. CrowdVested is using the Invest Georgia exemption, and Georgia is one of the lead states in the nation. And
there's only a handful, right?
Yeah, there was two at the time that Georgia – there's one other at the time that Georgia passed their law. That was Kansas. Now there's eight.
And oh, wow. So that's catching on.
It's starting to catch on, yeah. Alabama just this year passed their own. I've heard that Florida has got one in the works. Texas has passed one that is going to be online this fall.
And this is, just to educate our listener a little bit, this is for Georgians can invest in these Georgia things, or people out of state can invest in them as well?
It's just Georgia. Just Georgia. Let me give a little background about how this works. So the way the laws have always worked is they're designed to protect the small investor, and they're designed to prevent fraud. And what's happened is that all these great investments in startups, in other companies, in businesses down the streets, in commercial real estate – those have been excluded from 98% of the population.
Right.
And the laws were worked that way on purpose. So they said, look, if you don't have at least $1 million in assets or make $250,000 a year, then you're not allowed to invest in these things. And so if you make more than that, then all of a sudden you're sophisticated.
Well, you're an accredited investor.
You're an accredited investor,
and
exactly.
So you can make dumb moves.
You can make dumb moves.
You don't have to, with our blessing.
You don't have to be smart, but right? You've got money, so we don't care.
But for some reason, casinos allow anybody to go in and make dumb moves.
Yeah, yeah. You can go blow
$10,000. You don't have to be an accredited investor to go in a casino, right?
Absolutely not.
But to invest in somebody's business locally, you have to be an accredited investor, the one that you eat at every week.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I'm sorry for the tangent, but it just hit me. It's been bothering me all the morning. Brett Cooper looks like Daniel Craig in Casino Royale.
we're going full circle.
Okay, back to our regularly scheduled programming. You've heard that before. I know you have. All right, go ahead.
So they tried to pass a crowdfunding bill through the U.S. Congress, and this was in the fall of 2011, actually. And it passed, didn't go through the Senate, and then it got wrapped in again that next spring into the Jobs Act. Now, unfortunately, you know, like watching a sausage get made, once it came out the other end, it was a...
wasn't what it was when it started, was it?
It was not what it was. And they gave the SEC a mandate to have all the regulations done by the end of 2012.
And things move at government speed. And where are we at with that?
they still aren't done.
Still working on that.
Still working on it. That's right. But to be fair, the law that came out is so unworkable and so unusable.
It's shocking, isn't it?
It's awful. Yeah, I'm shocked. So now, fortunately, Georgia, they saw what was going on, and they said, look, this is a great way for people in our state. We understand this. We get this. We understand that small business is having a hard time accessing capital.
Right.
And we're going to take an we're making an experiment. We're going to use these philosophies that were they try to do at the federal level and have it work here in Georgia. And to their credit, they passed a great law that's fair. You know, it still doesn't allow fraud, but allows companies to go out and raise money, use social media, heck, take out a billboard ad or a blimp if you want, and raise money for their business. It allows folks like us to help them without having to go through an $80,000 registration process.
So now talk about a typical project that you are working on.
So we're focused exclusively on real estate in Georgia, and we have three projects right now that we have up on our site. If we have two, we've got one coming up tomorrow. The first one is a great project in East Atlanta, East Atlanta Village. Are you guys familiar with that area?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic area, up and coming, real hip. And it's a retail project. It's about 26,000 square feet of retail right there in the heart of East Atlanta Village. Paces Properties is the lead developer on that. They're a well-known in-town developer, just finished an award-winning project over in Old Fourth Ward, the Croc Street Market. And they are going to rehab that, put in a bunch of great tenants, and they're allowing the folks through CrowdVested to invest in that project at the same level as their other big equity investors.
So now how does that come about? So do you approach them and say, hey, you should carve out a portion of that that we can throw CrowdVesting at that? Because they could probably – did they have enough investment on their own?
They did, and they do. And we approached Paces through through one of our advisors, had a relationship with them, and told them about how crowdfunding works and why it's good for the developers. And in this case, Paces likes it not just because they have a new access to capital, but also because we're reaching out to the neighborhood in general and saying, hey, you can own a piece of your neighborhood. You can own a piece of these stores that are right down the street from you and that you're going to be frequenting anyway. And so all of a sudden you've got 20, 50, 100 investors in this project who are now advocates for the success of that project.
And their neighbors and their users of the service and products that are being sold. So it's win-win-win all the way around.
That's exactly right. And the real neat thing is that if I've got $1,000 and I'm going to put it into my local store, and he's going to use that money to make a better store and to make more money, and then that money all then comes back to me and it stays in the community.
And I'm improving the property value of my own home.
Exactly.
That's right.
Right? By making it a more thriving community.
Right. And that is so different than what happens now. Right now, if you're a small investor, you have to give your money to a bank, or you have to give your money to Wall Street, or you have to give your money to some middleman who is usually somewhere way away from where you are, and then they decide where to invest it.
Right.
This allows you to decide where you want to invest, and you can stay completely local if you want to.
All right, let's get this thing focused on me where it belongs. I think I get the real estate thing, but could this just apply to business in general? For example, could we do this and say we want to put a studio in East Village? And
absolutely.
We want to do the same thing. Instead of a shopping center, we want investors for an East Village studio.
Absolutely. You could do your own site. You could go create your own website if you wanted to and say, hey, we are going to open up Radio X down the East Atlanta Village. We're going to rent this property. Here's our business plan. You can either say we want to borrow money from you guys, or we want you guys to invest in the property directly as an owner of the property or as an owner of the studio, and then give them either special returns, give them a money return, or give them free slots on the radio. However you want to do it.
Is what I was thinking.
Coffee mugs. That's right.
But so, that's not your business, though. You stay with real estate, but you're saying the legislation and the infrastructure is now in place that if we wanted to pursue that, we could without going to jail.
Absolutely. You guys could do it. A restaurant could do it. You know, anyone could do
it. That would be, though, only here in Georgia.
Only here in Georgia.
Right. We couldn't, or to one of the other states you mentioned.
That's right.
Now, from your, what you created this platform, so you're looking for more developers to throw stuff on there, and you're looking for more investors to match up. So you have to work both sides of this balloon, right?
Yeah. You know, if you're, we're talking business models, we've got a two-sided business model, essentially. We've got the developers, which is, you know, they have to understand everything, understand how it works. We want to vet them, make sure they have high integrity, have a good business plan.
Right.
And then on the investor side, we need to educate them as to how this works, why it's real, why it's now legal. It's been illegal for 100 years. Why you can now do it, and why it's a great return or as a great investment opportunity.
Now, what's the downside for you're the developer, and now you got 100 more investors. Like, is that 100 more people going, hey, when's this going to be built? Hey, when do I get my free coffee at the coffee shop that's supposed to open there?
That's potentially a problem, but what we do to mitigate that is all the investors go into a special vehicle we form.
Special vehicle?
A special purpose vehicle, a limited liability company that we form.
Uh-huh.
And the investors go in there, and then that one LLC then invests in the real estate directly.
Uh-huh.
So the developer only has one investor. He's got the LLC.
Right.
Nice.
And so we manage the communication with the investors. We manage, all.
So you're the one that's going to be yelled at by the investors, and then you're going to yell at that person.
That's right. Now, part of it is we want this to be as transparent as possible. So we're asking all of our developers to give weekly updates once the project starts as to where things stand. Even if it's just a snapshot, hey, we poured foundation today,
right,
or got new chandeliers, or that kind of thing, so you can see what's going
you're
on.
You're probably going to do more of that than in a typical investment vehicle, just because of the nature of the people that you're working with. And
yeah.
So technically, maybe not any more or less safe than any other investment, but for someone who might be a little more inexperienced, maybe a little safer for me because I am part of this LLC crowd with some folks that kind of know what they're doing.
Right, right. So, and you're also co-investing along not with your fellow crowd investors, but at least in the PACE deal, with real sophisticated investors who are putting in $500,000 into
Got
the project.
It.
You're putting in $500,000, they're putting in $500,000.
So. It's like having the cheapest house in the nicest neighborhood, right?
So, but the one thing that's kind of shocking to a lot of these investors who haven't dealt in this area before and don't understand how the returns work is they say, okay, what are the returns? And it's like, well, the internal rate of return, which is what you expect over the life of the project, is projected for this project at 16-18%. And so that's where every year you can get a 16-18% return. And on a cash flow basis, it's projecting a 12% cash flow, per year. Folks look at that and they say, that can't be right. That's more than I can get anywhere else. It's like, well, that's the commercial real estate world. You're putting money in the equity portion. The bank is taking 60% of the deal, and they're lending it out at 6% or so. And then the sponsor's putting in about 5 or 10%. This is portion, while it is risky, it's what these accredited investors have been demanding and have been getting. So this is a very market return for this type of investment, but you just haven't had access to it before because you haven't had $250,000 to invest before.
So now walk us through, say somebody in that neighborhood says, you know what, this is a no-brainer. I live in the neighborhood. I want to invest in my neighborhood. So I'm going to, I have to give you $100,000? Like, what's the point of entry to get in on something like this?
$500.
$500.
$500.
So for $500, I get I'm a little teeny.
You get a small piece.
Well, you get $500 plus a projected 16-8%, 12% cash flow.
Yeah.
And then so then I just.
It's a money machine.
But I just get it like I'm investing in a mutual fund.
Sort of, yeah. So you go to our site and you say, okay, I want to. It'll ask you who you are and it'll your address, make sure you're a Georgia resident.
Right.
And then it will say, how much do you want to invest? And you have a drop down. You can invest between $500 and $10,000. There's a $10,000 cap here in Georgia, unless you're accredited, and then you go over that. And so say you want to invest $2,000. It will then give you all the investment documents that you can download and read. When you're ready to complete the transaction, you just digitally sign the documents, and you put in your checking information. And when the deal closes, we take the money out of your account and send your certificate, and you're invested.
And so is it the same as like a Kickstarter that if it doesn't hit the number that you need, then it doesn't happen?
That's exactly right,
and it's a no harm, no foul kind of thing?
Yeah. In fact, we aren't even taking your money out of your account until the deal actually closes.
Right. So if the deal closes, then you're in and then you're invested. If it doesn't, then you can part friends and it didn't cost you a dime.
Yep.
Good stuff. I mean, definitely worth checking out. Now, if somebody wants to learn more, do you guys have a website?
Sure. Crowdvested.com. And that's crowd, V-E-S-T-E-D.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you. It was great.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for Stone Payton. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.